Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. One of those Sunday mornings where we're looking at those maps in the Gulf and seeing, where is this thing going to go? Where is it going to go? You know, I could give you advice on what you should do now, but these are all things, anything that I could give you good advice on, you should have done weeks and months ago. But if you want to talk about trees in your yard, let's talk about them. Maybe we'll get lucky. There's a good chance folks in Alabama will, and the hurricane will not run ashore on Alabama. But if seeing a hurricane in the Gulf gets you all excited, that's a good thing. And maybe you can begin thinking about things you should do in your yard, and we'll talk about that. You feel free to give me a call this morning. But you know what? I think what I'm going to do, because we'll have other opportunities to talk about hurricanes, won't we? This is hurricane summer. This is the Southeast. Hurricanes are part of our lives. And we'll have other opportunities to talk about that. But this morning, I've been thinking a lot about the difference between farming and gardening. And the reason I'm thinking about the difference between farming and gardening is I'm doing a little bit of both now. Serious kind of farming, at least when I'm up to, by that I mean what I'm doing is now I'm talking about in acres, not in square feet. And it's a different sort of thing, different thing I'm thinking about, but and how I'm doing it, and we can talk a little bit more about that farming in acres, and it's a good thing to talk about occasionally. But let me tell you a little bit about how gardeners really mess up when they think their garden is a farm, when they try to borrow ideas for gardening to put in their farm, borrow ideas from farms to put in their gardens, excuse me. And vice versa as well. I've seen farmers use really bad gardening ideas in their pastures and other places. But let's think about it. You know what? The difference is scale, isn't it? And that's the big one. And I could... The problem is we take all these tools we get that are designed for the farm, like tractors, and we try to put them, squeeze them into the garden, and it doesn't work there. And so we make the garden bigger and bigger and bigger so we can rationalize having these big old farm tools in our gardens. And you know what? It's a mess. I'll tell you, I've been driving around the countryside, and this is not about my gardening skills, because I am continually impressed by the poorness of my gardening skills sometimes. It really has to do about how you're thinking about things and how you're doing things. And I'm driving through the countryside, and there are lots of people who have, you know, they come from farming backgrounds. They may not do it anymore. They're probably mostly renting out their places to the very few farmers that are left in Alabama, and there aren't many. I mean, there are vast areas there's this huge area, like, hundreds of thousands of acres where there are four or five farmers left, and they all manage all of those acres here in parts of Alabama. It's really quite remarkable. But it's very interesting to see that they try to apply what they see farmers doing in their gardens. And so they get a tractor, somebody comes by with a tractor and tills it up. Now, if you're going to put a tractor in the ground, if you're going to get a tractor to plow or till, or you got to till, you don't want to just do like a little bit of space. You got to make a really big space, right? Because it doesn't make sense to have that big old machine and just do a little bit of space. Go ahead and do it really big. So they do. And you know what happens by midsummer? These are beautiful gardens. They look so pretty when they put them in. It's all that bare dirt. Everything looks like it's going to be so neat, and their yards are so neat because they mow them all the stinking time. I mean, just obsessively. You know how we are. And everything's very neat, but then by June and July, the garden is just, you can't get through it. The weeds are so thick, nobody knows what to do about it. You can't really get to it to tend to the weeds, and the garden is just going to poop because for several reasons. It's not just that the weeds are doing better. It's that the plants themselves are doing poorly because there's been no attention to soil. There's been no attention to mulch. It's all about trying to do things like farmers do on a massive scale. And what they don't realize, and they say, well, God, you know, this guy that's planted corn, he planted corn next to me, and he doesn't go out there. He didn't cultivate that corn patch. He doesn't pull the weeds. He said the weeds just... What they don't realize is that they're using Roundup Ready corn that they can just spray Roundup over to kill the weeds. Now, that isn't working as well as it used to, but it works well enough that it looks like it's a smart thing. And people don't understand, you can't do that in your gardens. You can't do that in your gardens. Gardens are about, just forget about what your farming neighbors are doing, because what they're doing is crazy. It ain't right for what you're trying to do in your yard. It ain't going to work there. So this is why I always say, don't use a tractor in your garden. Don't use a tiller in your garden. Don't create a garden space that is a miniature version of a farm. Your garden space should look like a garden. It should have beds, just like you're growing flowers in. It should have a mulch, just like you put around your shrubs. It can be done with a fork. It doesn't need machinery at all. In fact, machinery is going to be a big hindrance, a huge hindrance, when you're creating your garden space. Don't try to learn from farmers, because that's a different sort of thing altogether. Think about, how do I make a really great garden space that looks like a garden, that acts like a garden, that's like with beds, that's simple to walk around? And I want to tell my neighbors that, and they say, God, it's so easy to go in with a tractor. Yes, it is. And it's absolutely impossible to manage that garden. Impossible to manage that garden after several months. And it looks bad. My garden's looking great. I got to say, my tomatoes are incredibly productive still. Very carefully chosen tomato varieties, not all of them, but some of them are doing great. Peppers are doing great. Okra's doing great. Weeds, yeah, I got some weeds. I'm working on them. But, you know, a lot of my beds really don't have any weeds in there at all. And that means, and I got Bermuda grass. Oh, man. Bermuda grass, excuse me. And it's still doing okay. But I'm thinking about those beds as if it's a gardening bed, not as if I'm out there farming. Now, if somebody can help me figure out how to make farming work as well as gardening does, that'll be something. If we could somehow take what we learned from gardening and turn it around and put it on our farms in all the right ways, that would be really, really neat. That would be really cool. But it's a little difficult to scale up. And it's even harder, though, to scale down. Just one thing I'm thinking about this morning. Hey, give us a call. Let's talk about the right tools for your garden this morning, if you have any questions about that. What tools do you need to make a garden, not to make a farm? Well, you asked me about tools for farms too, but let's talk about tools this morning. Let's talk about hurricanes if we need to. Let's talk about your garden. Let's talk about living in the South. Let's talk about living along the Gulf. Let's talk about living in Alabama and what it's like. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. I've been thinking a lot about this, and Sean sent me a message saying that he had tried this, one of our Sean's out there, and that he had tried this, I mean, I think probably plowing with a tractor. It's just a bad idea. You know, it makes you feel like a real farmer when you're on a tractor. I know that because I now have a tractor. But unless you really don't need a tractor, unless you're really up into the acres, and even then it's got a problem. I sometimes think, and I love this tractor. It's a great old tractor. It's what I could afford. It's a 1970s tractor. Nice International. And I wish I could afford the implements for it. That's one of the problems when you get a tractor. But, you know, it's interesting. I almost think even when I'm up to, many acres that I'm going to have to be dealing with, and that's probably, I'm going to say, about 40 acres. Even at that scale, I sometimes almost think a walk-behind tractor is more useful in some cases. And it just depends. We have a sense that the bigger is better with machinery, and it isn't always, usually isn't. And you don't need that much horsepower. The bigger the horsepower on a farm, the more trouble you got, the less you can do with it. That's true. Honestly. The bigger, the more horsepower you've got on your tractor, the fewer kinds of crops you can grow. It's that simple. It's just that simple. These big tractors, they're designed for a few commodity crops, not for the kind of crops that most people would want to grow and make money doing, really, without price supports from the government. So just things to think about. Keep it small. Keep it simple. And what does that mean? What tools really work? And, you know, I keep coming back. I got a couple of tools I use all the time. A broad fork, which is really cool. If you don't know what a broad fork is, you call me. Let's talk about it. It's a really nice tool. But that may be too big, too. It's got two handles. It's about, two handles that are about as tall as I am. And it's about, 2.5-3 feet wide. Not quite 3 feet. 30 inches wide. With a bunch of teeth on the bottom, and you just kind of lean back like you're running a two-armed, one-armed bandit, if you can imagine. Like you're there at the jackpot machine, you know what I'm talking about, and you just kind of lean back, pull that back, and let those teeth dig into the soil and lift the soil up, crack the soil without inverting it. It's a great tool. But that may almost be too big for most purposes. And a good old garden fork, man. It's amazing what a garden fork can do. And a rake, garden rake, really important, really useful. I'm actually using a fire rake now as my garden rake. It may be slightly more useful than some types of landscape rakes. We can talk about that. But simple tools make a huge difference in gardening, and those are the kinds of things you should be looking at. You don't need an expensive irrigation system. You need something really simple. You probably want some kind of simplified irrigation system, but don't make it too complicated. You call me, we'll talk about it. Hey, Charlie, we got a caller. Who's Gary? I'm listening. What's up?
Okay, this is really relevant to your subject that you've been been talking about. I'm a member of a church in Chickasaw, and we have a youth group that sells pumpkins every year. And I asked them how much they made, and they said about $1,500. I said, how much the pumpkins cost? They said about $1,500. So I said, well, if you grow your own, you can double your profit almost. They said, yeah, but we don't know how to grow them. So my wife and I took the task. So we got 101 vines growing in our backyard in little pots, did real well. Took them up to my camp in the Black Belt between Lamison and Thomaston. And it's right on the bottom lobe of the Black Belt. And it's difficult dirt to work with. Anyway, tried to till it. We've got a 2-acre yard at our camp house, and it gets mostly sun. Tried to till it with a wall behind tiller. It wouldn't break. So we used our tractor and we turned it 100-foot by 100-foot patch. I planted them, put a sprinkler out there, watered them. Over a period of time, more and more of the vines quit growing or died. I ended up with one long vine that did really well that now has only 8 small pumpkins. So my pumpkin project has been a disaster. So I'm hoping you can give me some wisdom to help me do better next year assuming I undertake the same project.
Yeah, Gary, so this is so pumpkins are their own trouble. There's no question. It's not easy to grow pumpkins in much of Alabama, though in the Black Belt, you're going to do better. And I know that part of the state very, very well, extremely well. That's where I learned about farming, unfortunately, at 17 years old. But let me tell you a little bit about Black Belt soils first. The more you churn those soils, the more you turn them, the more you destroy them. The Black Belt you might notice that the Black Belt is called the Black Belt because it once had very black, rich topsoil. And you may notice that you don't see much rich, black topsoil on those gray clay soils in the Black Belt anymore. And the reason is we burned it up by plowing it, which you can do. You burned up all the topsoil. You burned up all the organic matter. There was 10,000 years at least of topsoil, and we burned it up probably, I would say, about 100 years at a time. Every time we plowed, we probably got rid of 100 years of topsoil or more. And so when you till it, you make it worse. And you actually create that clay turns into clods that really don't have any, they've lost all of their integrity now. And so they don't really absorb water in the right way, so you're going to end up with a disaster. But let me tell you about my dad's garden. Dad had some Black Belt soils not far from where you're talking about, one county over. And he said, oh, son, I'm going to buy me a tractor. He bought a tractor. And I said, Dad, you put that tractor down in the garden, you're going to lose the garden. He didn't want to pay attention. You know how dads are. Yeah, somebody's diapers he changed, he ain't going to get any advice from. Not that he actually changed the diapers. I think my mother probably did all that. But you know how it is. So he didn't take my advice for a while, and he made a mess. And then I said, Dad, let's start over here. Let's start over. I said, you got all this horse manure in your barn. You got all this hay. Let's just start putting it down. Let's create the topsoil we used to have again, and let's don't till it. Let's don't break it. Let's don't crack it anymore, because we're making a mess. If you ever till that Black Belt soil, and even breaking it, which I did with a fork, but you can only do that within a narrow window of time. If it's too wet in spring, you can't do it. If it's too dry in summer, there's like a few weeks a year when it's actually possible to break it. And I just said, let's don't even worry with it. It's too hard. Let's try to get rid of the Bermuda grass as best we can. Let's lay on the organic matter. And that turned into the most productive garden I have ever had. It was incredible. You could grow anything. Now, even pumpkins, probably. Though I didn't spend a lot of time growing pumpkins, I'll tell you. But it makes all the difference rebuilding that organic matter, making it good, rich topsoil again. It recombines with that clay. That clay then becomes, I could stick my, you know how stiff that clay is in the black belt? You can't even, you could take a hammer to it and it wouldn't break sometimes.
That's right.
But you could, I could, by the time I was through, and I, you think I'm making this up, I could stick my hand into the soil. I could stick it in a foot deep just without any trouble. Because it had that nice black topsoil on it. So you got to have that organic matter in the black belt. There's 1,000 ways to do it. You can do it with hay. You can do it with manure. You can do it with leaves. The manure is less important than the hay. A little bit of manure is fine, but you don't need a lot of it. It's the hay. It's the other organic matter. And you just lay it where you want those beds to be and put your plants in there. It makes all the difference. Now I got to go to break. And then we're going to, Gary, we're going to come back and talk about pumpkins in just a minute.
Walk along the river, sweet lullaby. It just keep on flowing. And don't worry about where it's going. No, no.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Listen, so Gary, we didn't get this done with Gary. And I want to finish with the conversation with Gary real quickly because it's an important conversation. Black belt soils. Gary, I hope you're still listening. Didn't mean to lose you. Black belt soils are really the densest soils in some of the, maybe the densest soils in the world. They're really interesting. They have a huge electrical charge, negative electrical charge, which means that they hold on to everything. The old geologists used to say nothing ever leaves the black belt, and what they meant by that was is that soil tended to hold on to nutrients and organic matter and other things really well, and moisture really well over the long haul. But it really only works when there's, because they hold, the particles hold on to each other very tightly as well. And that's why you can't break it. And the only way to break that tendency for those particles, these tiny, tiny black belt clay particles, which can be very rich, unless they cling to each other too tightly, and they do, when you see that gray soil or that red soil that's really dense, the only way to loosen those bonds and allow that to function like soil again, so that roots can get down into it, is to add organic matter. Because organic matter has a stronger electrical charge than the clay does. And it reorganizes the clay so that it doesn't cling to each other so tightly and roots can begin to work their way down. So the black belt was pretty rich at one time. Black belt soils also have another tendency. They hold on to water for a long, long time in spring, right? They stay wet for a long time. And then they start drying out. And when they dry out, there ain't no water left in them. You can't re-wet them. They start cracking. They get these big fissures in them. And it tears roots to pieces. One of the reasons you didn't see a lot of trees in the original black belt prairie was because it just ripped tree roots apart, and only certain trees were well adapted to that. And trees only grew in certain areas in the Black Belt. It was an interesting thing. It was a prairie. It was the Black Belt prairie. It was a canebrake. It was many things, but it was not the kind of dense forest we're used to now. So there it is. It's very interesting soils, but the organic matter made it rich. It's what made it rich. Originally, it was 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 100,000 years of organic matter forming on those soils, and we farmed it out. We basically plowed it, and it turned into powder. The organic matter it turned into carbon dioxide gas, disappeared to the atmosphere, literally. That's what happened. And maybe methane as well. So all these things, it just disappeared as a gas because we plowed it so often. It oxidized. We lost all that topsoil. But you can get it back. You're probably not going to get 100,000 years back. But, you know, if you play it right, you can pump a century's worth of organic matter into that soil in a very short time. You just got to think about it. You got to put that organic matter back into it. I'm telling you, it's amazing when you do. It will be, and I've got some pretty good tomatoes. But I will tell you, I think the Black Belt tomatoes that I grew were probably the best tomatoes I've ever grown. I don't think everything was perfect. But gosh, the okra, it was incredible. The butter beans are absolutely incredible with that organic matter. What else did I mean, just tremendous, tremendous productivity. The winter crops were great with those soils. They really are great soils, but you got to understand, you got to have that organic matter. If you have any questions about how to get that much organic matter, you just call me. We'll talk about it. It's really, really kind of a smart way to do it. Now, pumpkins. Let's get back to pumpkins real quickly. To stay on topic, we're going to try to get to some of the other callers here in just a minute, but I want to get to the pumpkins. Pumpkins, there are three groups of pumpkins in North America, and pumpkins are all from North America, basically. True pumpkins, the true squash family, they're all related. So there's the summer, what we call summer squash group, which is Pepo, P-E-P-O, Cucurbita Pepo. And most of our yellow squash is typical of that. Zucchinis are typical of that. There is another group called Maxima, Cucurbita maxima, and the classic big orange pumpkins that people carve up for Halloween are in that Maxima group. And there's another group of pumpkins, and this is a really important group, Moscata, M-O-S-C-H-A-T-A, Moschata. Moschata, I don't care. You can pronounce it either way. You don't care either, do you? Moschata, Moscata, M-O-S-C-H-A-T-A. Those are the three main groups of pumpkins. Now, in the Southeast, probably the pumpkin that is closest to being native is the Moscata group, M-O-S-C-H-A-T-A. And that includes things like Seminole pumpkins and butternut pumpkins, butternut squash, as we call them. And those grow really well. And the reason they grow really well in the South, there are many reasons. One, I think they're kind of adapted to this climate and these soils pretty well. I think their root systems are better. But they also have solid stems, which means that you don't get the vine borer so badly. And I suspect the vine borer is what got the pumpkins in the Black Belt, as well as the bad soil. So we got vine borers that just make it impossible. It doesn't matter whether you could spray it with anything you want. You could put a systemic on it, but then you can't sell it. The vine borers are a huge problem. So solid stem squash are really important. David Hubble, are you listening? You were asking. Moscata, M-O-S-C-H-A-T-A. Anytime you see that a pumpkin you want to grow or a squash that you want to grow is a Moschata or Moscata, M-O-S-C-H-A-T-A, you know it's going to do better in South Alabama than the other squash because it's got a good strong root system. It's going to be resistant to squash vine borer. It's often resistant to squash bugs, which I don't see that much in South Alabama, but it could be there. You could see it in the Black Belt. So it's those Moschata squash, the Moscata squash, that are really good. There are few of those that make really big pumpkins like you sell at the grocery store. Those come from Indiana. But they make cute pumpkins, and some of them can be really big. There's a big version of the Seminole pumpkin that's out there that actually makes some very carvable pumpkins. And they look a little bit different, but they're fun, and they're fun to play with. Machada is really interesting. If you want to grow the traditional grocery store pumpkin, the kind that have been bred to be supersized and that are very carvable, you're going to have a challenge. It's hard to grow because we got lots of pests, we got lots of obstacles, but that's in the group Maxima. I think if you're in the black belt, you're going to be better off doing that as long as you don't have the squash vine borer. If you're going to, the problem with growing pumpkins is that the earlier you plant those pumpkins, the more they're going to avoid the squash vine borer. But the problem is they'll be ripe and they'll rot before Halloween. What a dilemma. So it's tough to grow pumpkins. It is tough to grow pumpkins that look like grocery store pumpkins. But you can grow. Our Moscata squash is absolutely incredible. And Seminole pumpkins are absolutely the most delicious thing in the whole world. You might check that out. I don't know that you're going to be able to market them the way you're talking about, because people want, they want things that look like what they buy in the grocery store. But we have a hard time on that. Hope that helped. And if you've got any more questions along those lines, you give me a call. We got a caller, Charlie. You said we... Sadie, are you still there, Sadie?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, now you said you've got some extra onion sets. Is that correct?
Exactly. I always plant 260 rows of onion every year. And I've planted what I want already, and I've got a ton of them left.
Yeah, so Sadie, I'm learning from you, and so what's interesting is that you're planting earlier than I would have planted, but you're apparently having good success planting this early.
I've got onions a foot high already.
Yeah, and they bulb up real good come spring.
Yes, I never have to buy green onions.
Yeah, so you're just growing the green onions, right? But they are bulbing up as well, right?
Yes, they're multipliers. Uh-huh.
Oh, they're multipliers.
Yes.
So do they form bulbs as well, Sadie?
Yes, they do, and I break them apart when I replant them, see?
I see. So you've got multiplier onions. This is good to know. That's good to know. And Sadie, tell me roughly where you live. Don't give me your address. Just tell me where you live roughly.
I'm on Bay Road, right across Dog River.
Well, that is good to know. So, Sadie, those are very valuable. And they're multiplier onions. I wouldn't call them onion sets because that's a little bit different. Let's call them multiplier onions, and you've got bulbing multiplier onions. And what's even better is you've got some multiplier onions that are doing well in South Mobile County, which is tough.
My husband and myself, we have planted them. We've been down on the bay probably 30 years, and we've been planting them since then.
Wow. And do you know where you got them?
From a Mr. Fail that used to live on close to Nancy's down there. I had a little bag full, and they just keep multiplying.
Wow. Sadie, this is great. Charlie's making us take a break here. So
put them in the right hand.
Yeah, so hold on just a second. I got to take this break. But let's come back, Sadie. I want to hear a little bit more about it.
All right.
He's not in Iris or a wild rose, but a little flower of which I'll tell. Known as Brave, a cone.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Sadie, sorry for all the interruptions, and you've been very patient. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, thank you. And so Sadie has what? Listen, folks, what Sadie has is very valuable. And I would not do this casually. I would do this particularly if you're serious about promoting great gardening along the Gulf Coast. What Sadie has are multiplier onions that are doing really well in Central and South Alabama, and some in South Mobile County, Central and South Mobile County. It's very hard to find. Well, this has a guy, I don't know, she got it years and years ago. I know just about where she is. And listen, that's, if anyone is very serious about gardening, don't do this if you're not serious about it, and would like to have some of Sadie's multiplier onion sets, whatever we want to call them. They're little bulbs. They're going to be little bulbs that you're going to plant. She's breaking them off and pulling them apart. They're multiplier onions. If you would like some and you're willing to give them away to other people, I'm thinking about you, David Hubble, and anybody else who's got some space, you can. Sadie's willing to give you some of those. Now, Charlie has agreed to be a filter here. Charlie may regret it, but he agreed. So he's going to take a call in, and the first three callers, we're not going to keep doing this through the whole show, but the first three callers, if you're serious about multiplier onions and you're really serious about, figure out how to put you in touch with Sadie and get those things going. So a very valuable resource Sadie has. Sadie, thank you for calling and telling us about it.
I want to tell you one thing, Bill. I'm a leaf lover.
Yes, ma'am.
And when I see all these leaves piled beside the road, I think that's God's dirt. You know?
Sadie, you have hit leaves. You have hit the nail on the head. And you know, I was thinking about that. It's the same. We were talking about those black belt soils. It's the same on the opposite end on the sandy soils down there in Central and South Mobile County. Those are sandy soils. And they don't hold on to nutrients, but the organic matter in those leaves makes all the difference. And that's how we... That's how we do it. That's how we do it. And it's great. And I'm glad to hear you're doing that. Sadie, you're a great gardener. You're a great gardener for holding on to those onion sets all these years. Thank you.
I plant a garden every year, Bill.
Well, it is great to...
I already started a fall garden.
What do you got in it, Sadie?
I've got, you name it, I've got it. I picked bush snap beans the day before Christmas last year.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I haven't grown bush snap beans in fall. I should try that. You know, yeah. there are some great varieties of beans that we should be trying in fall. That's really good. That's really cool. That's neat, Sadie. All right. Charlie's got to get on the phone now to take all these calls, because I knew it'd attract
all
some
right.
callers.
Good to talk to you. I've talked to you several times before, but I'll be calling again.
Thank you, Sadie. Good to hear from you. All right. So Charlie's going to be occupied here for a minute. Yeah. So, Charlie, Charlie, wrong line. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so here we go. Now we're kind of sorting it out. So here we go. Let's see what else we got. Pulling out of the black fungus. I saw some ants on it, so I applied some Tall Star granulars. Pulling out of the black fungus. Okay, so let's talk about the black ants. When ants get into a tree, they do not eat the tree. They do not cause a tree to have rot. Getting rid of the ants doesn't solve any problems. I don't know what, but the black fungus isn't caused by ants, and it isn't, and the ants, all they do is eat the breakdown of wood that's already been broken down by fungus and other things. So there's no need to kill off the ants. It won't make any difference one way or another. And you really won't get rid of them. Maybe only briefly. So don't worry when you, if you see black ants, if you see black ants, if you see black ants in a tree, sorry, we got, I was afraid a little bit of confusion on the phone lines. If you see black ants on a tree, don't worry about the ants. The problem is there's a rot in the tree, and it's probably caused by water getting into the tree somewhere on the tree. So you need to figure that out. It may be now internalized in the tree so that you're not seeing it leak out anymore. But send me a picture of that tree, Tim. Let's talk about that, or you give me a call. And let's figure out what it is. That black fungus, and I also need to double check to make sure it's a live oak. So we'll do that. Let's see, what else we got? David P., we ought to talk about exactly, I would love to talk about this subject. David P. said, you know, but wouldn't a tiller do this? And I said, in a word, no. It's the worst thing. And, you know, one of the things that people do with tillers is they try to get rid of weeds. All they do is you're going to have Bermuda grass, excuse me, all these other grass, you're going to turn them in, they're going to come right back up. Tillers don't get rid of weeds very well. And that's one of the reasons why when I see these gardens that are just eaten up because people use a tiller, they look just neat as they can be when they first do it, but it makes it worse in the long haul. So there you go. We're going to be back.
The rain is falling through the mist of sorrow that surrounded me. The sun could never fall away. The bliss that plays around me.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It is an Alabama Sunday morning. We've been talking a little bit about all through Alabama today, and a good thing. Sorry for the confusion at the last bit. I knew it was going to be a little difficult. But we Charlie got it handled. Lots of phone calls, lots of Charlie had to have 15 hands to do it all. And, so it's kind of tricky. Listen, so I'm going to try to get back to some of the questions we didn't get to. Michael sent me a picture of several things. Yeah, he did send me a picture of Carolina elephant's foot. That is indeed elephantopsis. I'm going to say, I can't remember which one's the long-leafed one. I think that is probably, it's elephantopsis. We got the genus right. I'll have to look up the species. The flower that you have, Michael, above that with a little orange flag next to it, is a pretty rare thing. It's not super rare. It's only in a few states. Really, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and South Carolina, I think. It might get over into Louisiana or Mississippi, but it's going to be really, really rare there. It's a member of a family that, you know, if we only read books about Alabama, it would seem very familiar. But, of course, all we know about plants we get from, you know, England or Boston or somewhere, Michigan. And they don't have these flowers up there. Not like, certainly not like we do. It's a big genus down here. It's the Rose Gentian genus. Rose Gentians. And Sabbatia. S-A-B-A-T-I-A. S-A-B-A-T-I-A. You can look it up that way, Michael. Sabbatia. And that one is Sabbatia brevifolia. You know, it's you'll see that the center of the flower is what made me think Sabbatia, but it's Sabbatia brevifolia, it's not a common thing. It's usually a bog associate, or it's usually associated with bogs, or it's associated with wet savannas. Be interested to know where that is. It's a nice place. Could definitely use a fire there, I can tell. To help that plant to grow. Has very small needles, but it's the white rose gentian. Let's call it the white-flowered rose gentian, or the white small-leafed rose gentian, if you want to stack a bunch of names together. Most rose gentians are pink or purplish or reddish. This one is pure white and kind of pretty, isn't it? Really a cool thing. That's good. Let's see who else we've got here. David sent me a picture of some seeds, and David, here's the thing. I am fairly certain that those seeds are not pawpaws. I think they are buckeyes. Now, it's a picture, and I could be wrong, but they definitely don't look like pawpaw seeds, which are flattened and dark and don't have a little eye on them. They're not round like that. I think what you got is a buckeye. So, was it in a leathery case? Did you see a buckeye nearby? You know, one of the tricks with buckeyes is by the time they drop their seeds, the leaves often have fallen off because they're very early deciduous. There you go. So what you've got is a pretty sure it's a buckeye, David. So there it is. Let's see here. So what we've got on that black fungus on that oak, nothing to do with ants, not in the trunk at all. There were some aphids on that tree. Or there was an aphid on a tree that was over that tree. Can't tell which. Maybe it was a scale on the tree itself. It is hard to tell. And that left a sooty mold. The black fungus is completely harmless. Completely harmless. That's actually a fungus that grows on poop. It grows on insect poop. We just have to say those things out loud sometimes. What's producing the poop is the issue, not the fungus. So we need to see, is there another tree that's over this live oak? That's the first question. Are there branches over that live oak, Tim? If there isn't, we need to look at the tops of those branches to see if we see any scale insects or other things that might be producing the poop that we're seeing on that tree. But ants, not an issue here. probably not an issue at all, particularly black ants. Fire ants could maybe cultivate aphids, but that's not what's going on here. Something else is going on. So let's look around that tree a little more, take some other pictures. Tell me if you see any little white things on the undersides of leaves or on the branches, like little white little nodules that look like little white shells, scales on the tree. Tell me if you see that, and let's go from there, and let's try to figure out why that's happening, or if there is, if you happen to see another tree over that one, tell me what kind of tree it is, and I bet we could come up with what's going on there. Yeah, so David sent me a picture. What you've got, David, is looks like I am trying to see a buckeye. And that looks like, which buckeye is that one, David, that you got the nuts from? That is probably, I'm going to guess it's a white buckeye. But you can see it's going early deciduous. It's a compound leaf. It's a compound leaf. Buckeyes have compound leaves. If y'all have ever heard me use the word compound leaf, this is what that means. It means that there are a bunch of little leaflets all joined together, that the leaf itself is composed of several leaflets. So black walnuts have a compound leaf that's a big long stalk with lots of little leaflets on it. And they're like on a feather. They're feathery, like arranged on that stem. Don't look like a feather, but they're arranged like a feather with the little quills coming off, or the big quill in the center, and then the little pieces of feather all on that quill. You know how a feather is. That's one kind of compound leaf. Buckeye has another kind of compound leaf. It's palmate, shaped like a hand, palm, right? P-A-L-M. Palmate, however you want to say it. With usually often with three fingers or five fingers, right? Buckeye has five fingers. They're all connected at the base. That's one leaflet, and you can see those leaflets falling off, but that's a buckeye. It's a buckeye. Cool thing in and of itself. I wouldn't eat it. Yeah, you have a pecan orchard. So it's it's the pecans that are dripping. Something's in those pecans, and it's dripping on the live oak. The live oak probably doesn't need to be under those pecans anyway, but that's what's happening there, and that's the problem. So there's something up in those pecan trees. It could all be lots of things, including aphids. So it's pecans being notorious for insect attacks. But, yeah, that's what's happening to your live oak. It's growing with pecans. Dust and chestnut trees loaded in Daphne from Cliff. Yeah, that's really good. I have never had a dust and chestnut tree, chestnut fruit. They're hybrids, aren't they? I think between the Chinese, I don't think they're pure Chinese, and they're certainly not pure American. I don't know about the flavor, but you tell me, Cliff, what do you think? Do you like the flavor? I'm interested. It's chinkapins are delicious. I've never had a I did eat a chestnut once, an American chestnut once. It was quite good too. Will deer eat pumpkins? Deer will eat anything. I don't know that they go after pumpkins, but it's possible. Coyotes do. They're kind of famous for doing that. But we'll talk when we come back. Michael, good to hear you're burning.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, it has to happen, and does. That's just a reminder, that's all we need now. Listen, so lots of questions. Frank over on Fish River says, what are these pink things, these red things? I see them spring and fall. A fungus? Well, no. They're not, you don't see them in spring. You only see them in fall. If you see them in spring, you let me know. Because I've never seen them in spring. And I don't think anybody else ever has either. But they're what we call lycoris. They're spider lilies. Surprise lilies. They're one of the group of surprise lilies. They're from Japan, actually, and China. They're Asian, but they're traditional. They've been around in the South for a long time. The bulbs flower naked. It's a word. And that means that they don't have any leaves when they flower. The leaves come up afterwards. The leaves come up afterwards and last all winter long. So I guess that's kind of why you're thinking it might be a fungus, because you don't see any leaves. But the leaves are there. They just come up after the plants flower, and then they last all winter long. If you mow that area in winter, you will successfully get rid of those plants because you'll get rid of the leaves. But the leaves are kind of grass-like. They're longer than most grass, a little broader, a little darker green. Really a nice thing, like chorus. Yeah, a lot of people are seeing them. Jim in Georgetown. Jim, let me just say this. Sadie, if you get a call from Jim in Georgetown, and you're probably all occupied now, Jim in Georgetown is somebody I know is going to share those onions with other people once he gets them going. So if you get a chance to share them with him, Jim's a good repository for that kind of thing, and he shares. I like Jim. He's been pretty generous with us and with lots of other people. And Jim has got some persimmons coming. The beautiful looking persimmons. Jim has always got. Jim and David Hubble always have some kind of amazing something going. I don't know what they do with all this stuff. Jim's got, what did he say? He says, he got all his Japanese persimmons. They look beautiful. He's pureed them. I see cake, wine, and beer coming up in the not too distant future. The beer is interesting me. The beer is really interesting. The wine is really interesting, too. I think, Jim, I can't remember whether you said you've done a persimmon wine before. But I'm very interested, and I think persimmon beer is a pretty traditional American thing. Now, it's usually done with American persimmons, but I think it could be very interesting, a very interesting beer done with Japanese persimmons. Jim, I am waiting to hear about that. Let's see, what other callers have we got? What's going on with this hickory? If my memory serves me correctly, it was looking okay a couple of weeks ago. This is on Dog River. All transition. You know, we've seen a lot of hickory decline, particularly on the Gulf Coast, and it seems to be related to both drought and wind shake. So here's what happens. If we get a hurricane, this will frequently happen. Hickories don't like to have their roots disturbed, so they get moved around. They get jerked around in that wind. They don't die immediately, but they break roots. The roots get broken, and then we'll get a drought or a wet period. It could be either one, and it could be a combination of wet and dry periods. It will introduce rot into those cracks. It may survive the wet period and die during a dry spell because it doesn't have enough rain to keep the broken roots going that have now been infected with disease. Hickories don't like to have disturbed roots. And that's just something to think about when you plant a hickory next to your house or when you plant it in an exposed location. Be careful about doing that. And so it periodically happens. I think that's probably what happens here, and it will die suddenly. They seem to die quite suddenly, but it's the result almost always of a root infection, probably from Phytophthora, if you want to know the bloody, hard-to-pronounce details. Probably Phytophthora caused some root rot, but it was probably wind shake or other things that caused the problem. Does that help? Not much you can do to fix it now. Let's see. Somebody says, can you help me save my Mellotron? I wish I could. It did very well until 3 weeks of solid rain saturated my yard. Though it drained, thought it drained well, but you know, it does make a difference. Those, a lot of times, there's hard pans in those soils. If you, and there's also Phytophthora in those soils. There's lots of other issues, nematodes, lots of other things that can cause problems. We can talk about how your bed got started. If you want to, we'll talk a little bit about it, how you're doing your beds. It may help. But you're going to need lots and lots of organic matter, particularly in a flat savanna like that, particularly if we get 3 weeks of rain, which we periodically do anywhere in Alabama. And it can overwhelm the soil's ability to take it. And when that happens, Phytophthora and other things can take off. I hate to use the word Phytophthora again. You know what? Phyto means plants in this case. Thora is a Greek word, means destroyer. So if it helps you to sort of think of every time you hear me say Phytophthora, you can translate that into plant destroyer. I know what he's talking about. It's this water mold that lives in the soil. And it's pretty deadly. It really has affected the South in some pretty incredible ways. You really can't understand the South's history without understanding Phytophthora. It's really very important. And it will continue to be important as it moves northward, which it will do now because climate is warming. And it's warming more rapidly up north than it is down south. So we're going to see more and more Phytophthora up north. It's a pretty important disease, and it's those wet soils create conditions that are ideal for Phytophthora in combination with things like nematodes. And so sometimes you can sort of do two things at once. You can reduce nematodes, and you can improve your drainage so that you have more oxygen. And if there's plenty of oxygen in the soil, doesn't matter how much rain we've had, if there's still plenty of oxygen in the soil, you're going to be resistant to Phytophthora and quite a few other diseases, bacterial wilt. But you need to have plenty available. The way to fix that, and it works pretty well, is to use organic matter, and you just got to pour it on there. I mean, it ain't just about dribbling it on. It's about pouring it on. So where you're going to plant, you know, your beds need to focus on building organic matter every year, you know, 4 feet of organic matter, which is not hard to find. Sadie can tell you because she does it. You know, Sadie, you going to tell them? You just go get the leaves. It makes all the difference. And they break down so quickly. There it is. Yes, somebody asked me about spider lily. Is it a nickname called hurricane lilies? Yes. And we talked about those hurricane lilies. You know, the old timers would call them hurricane lilies. And it's a coastal name, but I see it even up into Alabama. Sometimes the hurricane lily name was given to the golden lilies only, but you know, I think hurricane lily is a good name, and it's a great name. It's hurricane summer. There are some lycoris that bloom in July before hurricane summer really gets cranked up, but you know, we got July hurricanes as well. Now there, and speaking of golden hurricane lilies, wow, speak of them and who should appear but Dan. And those are beautiful golden. Dan, where did those come from? Those are beautiful. Do you know where they came from? I'm curious. Just absolutely beautiful. There's several different types of golden spider lilies. They used to be more common along the coast. You can't find them in catalogs. But boy, are they beautiful. Just golden colored. Imagine those red spider lilies except golden. Really cool looking things. Also called hurricane lilies. We'll call them the golden hurricane lilies and the red hurricane lilies if we like. We got a break. I got to stop talking. But you give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Won't take long. Sing it right once or twice. Oh, Lord, and me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I got is done and gone.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Plain Gardening. Alabama Sunday morning. lots of questions. Boy, the Lycoris question really stimulated some interest. Glad to know, Dan, that was at the Botanical Gardens. I can't remember whether those were among the ones. I'm looking to see where it is. Did I plant some of those? I may have. I know we got some bulbs, but I can't remember whether those are ones, but that was certainly what we wanted to do. Right where you took that picture is where we wanted to use more and more Lycoris bulbs. Glad to see them there. The golden Lycoris don't seem to bloom as well every year. It's like they need a dry period or something. But they were very happy this year, and they did really well, really well. Finding the right golden Lycoris for us is tricky. And I'm not sure what species that there are. There are several species of golden Lycoris, and I have planted several in my yard. I don't know. I'm gonna have to listen and think about that. What else we got? So we're looking at these. We're looking at this, and when you've got, so what we're looking at. Let's talk about where we are. And I'm not sure from this picture who sent me this. South of Fairhope. So those were savanna-like habitats, and many of them were flatwoods, which meant that they didn't drain well initially, but there were lots of plants that were adapted to it when you had the topsoil, when you had lots of organic matter going into it. Now that we've converted it into, farms and then pecan groves, we lost all the topsoil. We probably also created hard pans, which meant that they drained even more poorly. Those areas around Fairhope, they can be really hard to farm and garden. I'll just be frank. It can be really tough because they don't handle water well. And I always tell people, if you want to handle drought, people worry about dry weather, but I said, if you want to handle drought in Alabama, you better handle floods, because it's the heavy rains that are going to cause the problems that you may not see until it gets dry. But it will cause all kind of rots and all kind of problems, and that's, you got to handle the rainfall. To do that in those areas, you really have to take organic matter seriously, and I think we keep coming back to this again and again and again on today's show. Organic matter is incredibly important. And it's not just a little bit, because we use up organic matter really fast. And that means topsoil isn't made once. Topsoil is made over and over and over again every year. Literally, you are creating, your topsoil is going to disappear if you're not making it every year in your garden. That is the absolute honest-to-goodness truth. So don't worry about, it's not the fertilizer you got to worry about. You might need a little bit, but you don't need much. That's easy. It's not the lime you got to worry about. You might need a little bit, but not much. That's easy. What you really need is the organic matter. you've got to have that organic matter, and you got to have large quantities of it, particularly on those sandy soils, because it just burns up very quickly with your garden. And much of it has already been burned up, so you don't have a reservoir of it. So what you need is you really got to supercharge it. You know, it's like this thing about the black belt. When I said that we would, what killed the black belt for farming? And much of the black soils of the black belt, they're gone. I mean, they are gone. And they were gone probably by the turn of the previous century. And they were gone because it didn't take long to burn them up. Basically, we had maybe 100,000 years. I'm going to say 100,000 years. Let's just say 100,000 years of topsoil accumulation. That may be underestimating it, of that black topsoil in the prairie. And you know what? Every time we plowed it, we used up 1,000 years. 100 years, 1,000 years, doesn't matter, a ton of that topsoil, because every time you expose that black topsoil and didn't put new organic matter into the soil, you lost it. You lost that layer. And so every time we plowed it, we went through 1,000 years or 10,000 years of topsoil, and we mined it. We literally mined it. It was exhausted, literally, as methane and carbon dioxide. It wasn't eroded in the sense that it was washed away by rain, though the rain didn't help things. It helped to break it down more quickly. The problem was it just turned into gas. And that's how we lose it. It's pooted away, as I sometimes like to say. There it is, and it happened fast in the Black Belt, but it happens much, much, much faster on those savannas in Baldwin County. So you really got to add the organic matter. I take when I'm starting a new bed, you know, people have heard me say this. I go get a leaf bag, and I dump the whole leaf bag right where I want it till it's about 4 feet high, till it stands about 4 feet high. If it's hot taller, it's even better. And then I dump another one right next to it and another one right next to it. 1 foot doesn't do it. 4 feet does. Now, I don't think you can do that where you've already got the melaton planted. But you can do it as you're preparing for next year's melaton crop. Just go ahead and build that organic matter up. Build it high. Build it good. It's really going to make all the difference in the world. Going to make all the difference in the world. It's over by the white pine. Notice the golden ones are a bit larger than the reds. I don't remember a white pine, but I think maybe that's interesting. I've forgotten about a white pine. Maybe it's a spruce pine. There is that funky white pine, isn't it? Yeah, I remember those being planted. Those may have, I think I know where those came from. I also noticed the golden ones are a bit larger than the red. So yeah, the golden hurricane lilies are bigger. They're more spread out, and you see the individual flowers more, but you definitely can see the family resemblance. They're all pretty closely related. Some great crops of lady peas out of central Alabama. I had a drought in May and June, so I got nothing from my spring planting. Yeah, that's one of those things. A lot of the state had that May June drought, and it's tough. But you know, if you get that organic matter, and you build it up enough, it'll allow you to get through those droughts pretty well. You just got to really add the organic matter. It's interesting, Clay, and this is the debate I often have when you say Central Alabama. I always think of Birmingham as really the gateway to North Alabama. And it has more in common, I think, with North Alabama than with Central and South Alabama. But it's kind of the gateway. It's kind of that transition city between Central and Northern. Interesting to think about. And it's about the middle of the state of Alabama. Where is the middle of the state of Alabama? It's down south of Clanton. Probably somewhere between Clanton and Montgomery, maybe Verbena. that's kind of the middle of the state. And by the time you get up to Birmingham, you're beginning to transition to the northern part of the state. That's geographically. But, yeah, we all had droughts. Birmingham's a really great place to garden. It has some great soils, but there a lot of them are clay. You got to work with them too. And I've worked with those soils around Birmingham several times in my life, coming in and out of there. Lady peas, beautiful things, aren't they? Just wonderful things to eat. Boy, I've had some great peas. They're kind of a whippoorwill variety that I've been growing for a while. Really great to have them in the yard now with okra. Did I tell you what I'm doing with okra? This is a cool thing. I almost thought about doing the show on okra, but I was afraid there weren't that many okra lovers. But tough. I love okra. Okra is a cool thing. And I grew a lot of varieties of okra. But here's what I did with the okra. It's really great. I brought them in. I sliced them down the middle. Get the iron skillet hot. Just get it hot. Don't warp it. Just get it hot. Don't put any oil in it. You don't have to put any oil in it. Take some okra. I split some peppers too. I took the hot part of the pepper out. There were ahi colorados. And then on some of them, and then left the hot part in on others. Threw it into that hot skillet. Don't turn it too often. Let it get really hot. Let it get a little darkened around the edges. Then flip it. Leave it just a little while. Don't let it get blackened, but just blacken the edges. Flip it again. And then after a few minutes, then you can add your oil. Don't need a lot. Don't need a lot of oil. You don't want to make it too wet. Just a little bit of oil to keep it going, to spread the heat around, and cook it that way in that iron skillet. It is absolutely delicious. And I just split them down the middle, top to bottom. Really delicious. Oh, incredibly good. You can add a little garlic with it if you like. Don't add it too early because you don't want to burn the garlic, but you can add that late in the process. Really delicious doing it that way. I've been experimenting with okra in several ways, and there's a lot of fun ways to do it. A lot of fun ways to cook okra, but I'm really kind of sold on this one. It's better than doing it in the oven. Just never works as quite as well in the oven, but really well in the black skillet. I got a big black skillet. You need a big black skillet to do this if you love okra. I got the biggest black skillet I could find. You could do it on a griddle, too. It would work pretty well. It's a little harder to contain the oil, but it's quite good on a griddle and really a fun thing to do. There we go. So we could spend a lot of time talking about.
When I was a child, my family would travel.
Talking about it. Yeah, Columbiana claims it, but it's kind of interesting. I think if you look at the weight of the state, the volume of the state, I think most of that volume is south of Birmingham. I don't see Columbiana as a center point from distance either. Not if
down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. So I did this. So we had a little bit of argument about what the center of the state is. So I looked at Calera. Some folks will know where Calera is. It's a little south and west of Columbiana, which I heard as a claim as the center part of the state. It's 205 miles from about 205 miles from Calera to Dauphin Island. It's about 143 miles from Calera to up to the northeast corner of the state, a little more than that, about 150 miles, actually 160 miles, up to the northeast corner of the state. So it's there you go. So it's somewhere south of Calera is the center point of the state, and then if you take the bulk of this, Dauphin Island probably isn't even far enough south. If we need to go a little bit farther south, it's probably like 220 miles south of Clara to the end of the state line. So there it is. It's, I think, the center point of the state for those who care. It's a little bit south of Birmingham, good bit south of Birmingham, maybe almost about maybe halfway between Birmingham and Montgomery, somewhere in there. That's why I say Verbena may be the center, of the state, pretty close to being the center of the state. You just got to, you know, don't forget the boot heel. Don't forget, there's this little thing down there in Alabama that goes way into the Gulf of Mexico. That's why I think it's important to think about. It's real. There are people who live there. Anybody live in the Boot Hill, Alabama? Any callers out there who live in the Boot Hill, Alabama, by chance? Yeah. Slapout. Could Slapout be? You know, that's Slapout. Well, Slapout is in Coosa County? I can't remember. I think it is. I can't remember. Where Slapout is. Maybe. That'd be about right. My grandmother made black ochre in an iron skillet, and it's always been my favorite. I have her skillet still, but still can't make it the same. So, you know, there's traditional fried okra is you bread it, you put it in lots of oil. You kind of do the same thing I'm doing, but you use lots of oil. What I'm saying is don't need a lot of oil, and you don't need to bread it, which makes it a lot easier. Fried okra is fine. It's a good thing. But, you know, I'll tell you, for a great okra flavor, it is really hard to beat just blackened okra in the skillet without being breaded and without too much oil. The oil, you sometimes lose a little bit of taste that way. Just a little bit blackened, really delicious, really delicious. Let's see what we got. I really want to call and ask some questions about birds that migrate through here next week. Yeah, well, so are you going to call in and after you've seen them migrate through here next week? There's going to be a ton of them. I wish I understood all those warblers that are going to be coming through. How does my mother say it? Wobblers. You know, it's hard to say warbler. Wobbler. But there's a bunch of them, and it's a time to be looking, and it's a great time of transition. You know what else is coming? You know what else is coming here very, very soon? The big return, my favorite return to Alabama, and it's going to be throughout Alabama. It's going to be really cool to see them, or the white pelicans. So they've been up in Canada nesting at what's left of, you know, and in Wisconsin, what's left of those big prairie areas where they can nest. They're up there nesting. They'll be coming back to the Gulf with the youngins, right? Or some of the youngins may stay on the range up there. I'm not sure quite how that works. But they're coming back. They're going to be big numbers, and they are the biggest wingspan, massive wingspans. I think it's about the biggest wingspan of any bird in North America, if not the biggest, except for the California condor. But massive wingspan, just beautiful birds in these huge squadrons, and they're going to be coming back, and it is the start of fall. You know, you're going to see that about October 1st. So Dan's going to call in next week. I'm going to show how much I don't know about all the different birds coming in, but we're going to talk about it. It's a good thing to talk about. Dan, it's a good thing to talk about. Good thing to talk about. Yes, and the monarchs are coming in too. So they're all going to be here. To understand, I think I've talked about this before. To understand how important monarchs are to how important Alabama is to the monarchs, and nobody else is paying attention to this, and we in Alabama don't pay attention, so consequently the rest of the world doesn't pay attention. Go down to Point of Pines. Check out what's left. There's not much left, but there's a little bit left of wild habitat around Fort Morgan. Check it out. Check out the monarchs. They're there all winter long. All winter long. They always have been. There's been documented there for not just decades, but more than a century. We've known that they were there, and people keep forgetting it. And somebody, I read the other day, somebody discovered that monarchs were overwintering on Fort Morgan. I don't know when they discovered that, because it was, people have been observing it for more than a century. It's written down lots of places. It's really cool. So it's something to think about. They're coming home for the winter, is one way to think about it. They're as much at home here for the winter. They're coming in for the, they're coming in for the winter. And they're as much at home here as they are anywhere. So just be on the lookout for them. Be on the lookout for them. Some people say wintering grounds. That's just where they overwinter. That's not their home. Well, yeah, it is. As much as their summer grounds. So lots happening now. Lots happening now with the birds, and we're going to talk about that next week. Did we get to, were there any questions we didn't get to? I'm looking through here. I guess not. Sadie, I hope you probably got more calls than Charlie's got to deal with. I hope you can manage them all just fine. And it's been good talking with everybody. Let's see what else we got. Anything else? Okay, Charlie tells me we got, it's a little confusing here this morning. Charlie tells me we got 30 seconds to go, but I think we pretty well covered everything. If there's anything anybody else needs to know, we did start out the morning talking about not thinking of your garden as a farm, and that led to a lot of questions as to how all that works. Maybe next week we'll talk a little bit about how the farm works. We'll be back next week.